Clap along if you feel like a room without. down in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. Fly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean. Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world, in a bold world for me. Shine, you know how I feel. Spend all the pine, you know how I feel. Oh, freedom is mine, and I know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me.
Make it at all. Who would have thought skinny be the one that's making this call? Lord, help me out. Tell me where I went wrong. I'm trying to find the righteous path, although it's never been long. I gotta do it for my son's sake, telling me daddy be strong. We gonna make it through these hard times, even though they go when they come. You're absolutely right, but something happened to me on last Tuesday night. It's plain as day, man. They with this world trade. No, raving the word I'm looking for ya. Better make it hope when nothing seems to matter. That's when, see, everything can go any which way. They got me folks, see, the Henny with the J. Front post chilling broke, country folk, man, I'm nappy in my way.
Yo, I've been fooled, but it really don't matter no more. And they wonder why we act this way. Daddy boy, it's gonna be okay.
We're gonna be okay.
Dressing, calm, let's join hands. Got to cope with the pressures of being poor, man. Right. Papa taught me in order to survive for no man. Nappy blossom from the roots, henceforth we gone, man. Prophet grew from a juvenile to a grown man. You gotta take responsibility for your own, man. Zoning, too blind to moaning by sunrise. Sometimes I love to hear my woman moaning and tone again. Damn, I hope he played his song again. The soul cleansing, the melody just rare my engine. Provide a lot of things, but usually just appending my ligament. Searching for Benjamin. All my folks locked in the sentiments, and it don't make any sense.
Why?
Children are sentencing, broadcasting from the slums. That's why I'm writing these sentences along my income. Why?
Go ahead, finish.
All my life I've been poor, but it really don't matter no more. And they wonder why we act this way. Let me know it's gonna be okay. All my life I've been poor, but it really don't matter no more. And they wonder why we act this way. Let me know it's gonna be okay. Okay.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. New life for me. Ooh, and I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on. It's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean. Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world, and a bold world for me. Stars, when you shine, you know how I feel. Spend all the time. It's a new day, it's a new life for me.
Continue to play a critical role in the lives of the members.
And then she telling her that the family continued to love their children pretty well and invest in them as best they can. And children aren't going to get that at school. They're not going to get that from teachers. We're not going to get it at work. Families do that day in and day out, intimate kind of stuff.
I would say that families are doing better than the media might portray, given the broad diversity of family forms and all of the economic and social changes of the last two decades. There's a popular myth that the American family is falling apart, it's in decline, it's a vanished species. And actually, I think the family is here to stay, although it's transforming itself in many ways that fit the challenges of our times. When people talk about whether the family is in decline, I think often they're thinking about it in terms of the functions that the family perhaps once served no longer being met by the family unit. So one example of that would certainly be care of young children that would be increasingly taking place outside of the family now, as women are no longer staying at home with the same numbers.
Some have argued that the family has become a bit obsolete in the eyes of children. The children look at parents as a bit old-fashioned and start looking to other media and other models for guidance.
Yeah, fortunately, because there's less parent-child interactions when we're looking at children involved in so many recreational activities. That probably has a negative effect on the well-being. Probably affects them throughout their lives. The need of children to have parents there monitoring and engaging them is not gone away. It's just that parents have less time and energy to do what they've traditionally done.
Most children now receive their education outside of the family. Care for the elderly is increasingly happening outside the family. So family, in that sense, has lost many of its functions. But for many people, it still occupies a central role in their lives.
Families are always changing. There are many indicators that show that families are no worse off and that people spend no less time with their kids than they used to. I think what we have is an evolving family system that meets the demands of people. There seems to be a lack of fit between some of our nostalgic ideals and the practices of everyday family life. But by and large, we're doing the same kind of changing that families have always done.
Those changes generally reflect similar shifts, taking place in society.
Families are always related to the economy, the politics, the culture of the society. So in other words, if a society is predicated on a certain kind of subsistence practice, that's going to shape what families are like. In herding societies, young people go out when they're 10 or 12 years old and they hang out with the sheep or the goats or whatever they're herding. That produces a kind of a loose bond between the pre-adolescents and their parents. In industrial societies, we tend to keep kids in school longer. And then college is that point where they might break, or after college, depending on what they're doing. In agrarian societies, we put people to work and have lots of kids and structure large families and put them all together in one room. The main point is the families are not separate from the society. Families and the economy and the polity are all wrapped up together.
Just as many societies have undergone tremendous change over the past two centuries, so too has the family. And yet the fundamental essence of this venerable institution somehow endures.
I think the family is just fundamental to the survival of the species. You've got to have some stable environment in which to raise multiple newborns, protect them biologically, and raise the system. I don't think the family will change very much. I think we've probably reached the peak of divorce rates. I think they'll probably level out, maybe even continue to go down, because I think as the norms of family structure change, men and women leave more important. So that big source of tension that's always existed in the family will be very dramatic.
Women's continued participation in the labor market, it's unlikely to undermine marriage to the extent that my own research and research of others suggests that, in fact, having a stable job, good earnings, actually are associated with an increased likelihood of marriage, not a reduction in marriage. I think one of the things that people had been concerned about was that these improvements in women standing in the labor market were somehow a threat to the family. And I think the evidence for that is pretty weak. If anything, I think it goes the other way, that probably the best predictor of family stability is this economic stability.
And people, when they do get divorced, will want to get remarried and have children again. That seems to be the trend. I don't think that's going to change. It's a fundamental to our species. We need to survive as a species, not the family. The family has to be sustained. Like, it's ensure the reproduction of species, and it's probably on some biological basis. It's not just blood to air by changing social transformation.
Our family is incredibly diverse, you know, in terms of culture, in terms of gender identity, in terms of age and region. Luna has six.
At the dropout rates of young African American males out of high school, and you look at the incarceration rates of African American males today in this country, it's alarming. Alarming. The black family is not monolithic. You know, it's multicultural now. You know, the African American family, it looks like, in certain ways, the Obamas, you know, a biracial man, African-American woman, and kids that have some measure of mixed cultural background and mixed grandparentage and all of that. But what the most disturbing thing for me with regards to traditionally underrepresented groups, the African-American family, et cetera, are the young people that I work with through my foundation, the Manifest Your Destiny Foundation. Three out of every four young person I work with is being raised by a single parent, usually a mother. We can talk about all the different socioeconomic factors, sociological factors, and all sorts of things that have transpired over the course of that, and whether having two parents in the home is really the most important thing. I believe that you have the best results when you have two parents in the home. Certainly economically you do. All the research bears out that when you have two parents in the home, the family saves more, does better, et cetera. Yet in many African-American families, we don't have that, and it's something that I think that all of us have to take a look at. In my book, The Conversation, I talk about the black family and different elements and aspects of it, and talk about how over time there's been this disillusion of the African-American family in certain ways. Some of the problems go back to slavery, and when you had the purposeful disintegration of a family unit where purposely the wives and the parents were separated from themselves, the husband's wives separated from the kids as well. And so some people think that there's a holdover sociological element there. Some other people believe that during the Industrial Revolution and through the onset of certain types of welfare laws, where it was almost encouraged in certain low-income communities for there not to be a male in the home because certain amounts of monies and food stamps, et cetera, were not given if there was a working male in the home. So number one, either had the male moving out of the house, or it had the male not working, which are obviously two not great results for the family unit. Coming out of the Industrial Revolution, moving into more of an office-based economy, there's a lot of talk by scholars about obviously it was predominantly white men making decisions about who they were hiring and not hiring that they wanted to work next to in their office. There, a lot of research had been done around the fact that many of the men, in this case Caucasian men, felt much less threatened by African-American women versus African-American men, so they would hire African-American women to work under them rather than African-American men, so African-American men did not make the transition into those jobs. So my book, The Conversation, is more about highlighting a problem, giving ideas about potential solutions, and hopefully in whatever way the reader feels like they can actually have impact and have a better result, because we have to do better. When you look at the dropout rates of young African-American males out of high school, and you look at the incarceration rates of African-American males today in this country, it's alarming, alarming. And then you look at the recidivism rates, you look at the unemployment rates, you look at the lack of cross-generational wealth transfer, you look at the health issues around young African-American girls are the fastest-growing population of HIV and AIDS. There are serious things happening, and this is just in African-Americans. It's predominantly lower-income, underserved communities. So then it evolves into a conversation about class versus race, which I believe is always a lost leader. It's a distraction because people want to talk, well, no, it's class. No, it's race. No, it's class. No, it's race. No, it's a problem that we have to solve, and we all have to figure out a way to solve problems.
Hey, what's everybody? This is Phil Harper. Subscribe to Thinker.
I first started dating girls and stuff like that. My older, she used to always tell me, you need to study their family dynamics. And I think I mentioned on a couple different occasions that, you know, my older, she was a trained psychologist and sociologist, so I grew up in a household where phrases and terms like that was just normal conversation. It didn't mean that I understood it. But, you know, I remember being like knowledge wisdom of 12 years old looking through the DSM manual, which is the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Illnesses, because that's something that we had in our house. So anyway, my old herb, she used to say, study their family dynamics. You know, you need to study their family dynamics. I didn't know what that meant, you know, but it took me time and a lot of experience to begin to actually understand what she meant by that. Now, family dynamics, when we talk about dynamic simply means force or influence. So when we say family dynamics, we're talking about the family influence upon an individual. And what people don't understand a lot of times is that the family who we are born with, whether we're a single child, whether we've been adopted, whether regardless of what those circumstances are, the people who are around us that have raised us, they represent our first training unit in life when it comes to family relationships or when it comes to being able to navigate different type of emotional experiences. You know, our family first introduces us to fear. We learn about happiness. We learn about disappointment. We learn about sorrow. We learn about joy. We learn about all of these different experiences through the family we were born with. And because it is our first training unit, this is where we learn our first skill sets when it comes to establishing or resolving or bringing closure to or also dissolving relationships. So once we leave the household, if we ever do, once we leave the household, we bring these skill sets with us into other different arenas of our life. And when my older used to say study their family dynamics, what she was essentially talking about is check out the influences that have shaped and molded this person into that image and likeness that they're in. Because they're going to bring those actual skill sets to a relationship that you want to possibly forge with them. So in other words, sometimes you see people and they may have disagreements or things that they don't like about their own physical family. All of us have that. And just because we do have a physical family, it doesn't mean that we have to accept everything that our physical family does. But what it does mean is that if we were born into this family and we were presented with these actual challenges, that it is important for us to strive to learn how to resolve those challenges with our physical family, because when we look at people and we say, oh, that's how they are, right? Or we say that's how their personality is. Personality is nothing more than a combination of principles and values. So in other words, when you look at a person, that is just simply a unique combination of principles and values. That does not mean that we're not going to meet other person in our life journey that have the same type of principles, that have the same type of values. So if I'm unable to bring closure to or resolve the things that I have with my own physical family members that have personality or principles or values that is disagreeable with the way that I see and do things, what makes me think that I'm going to have the skills to be able to handle that situation with somebody outside of my family that's not going to be connected to me for the rest of my life, who can simply walk away anytime they please? So if I could easily just walk away from being able to handle situations that I'm dealing with in a long physical family, it's going to be way easier for me to walk away from dealing with the same type of personality with people who are outside of my family. I'm easily going to be able to walk away from that because there's nothing that's connecting us. So when you're looking at a person, always find out how they're able to handle and deal with the different type of dysfunctions or the different type of challenges they have in their own physical family, because if they haven't developed the type of skill sets to deal with those things with their own physical family, what makes you think that they have those skill sets to be able to bring it to a new family that they're forming with you possibly? Where are they going to get those skills from? Where are they going to get the tolerance? Where are they going to get the understanding? Where are they going to get all of those things that is necessary to be able to bring closure to and to resolve those type of situations if and when they come up in your relationship? They're not going to have them. So, you know, like I said, my older put me onto this when I was at a very young age, and I didn't even know how to spell dynamic, you know. But this is something that I'm also taking initiative to share with some of you. Number one, it's very important to see how people deal with their own family issues. Because if they're unable and they lack the tolerance and the skills to deal with those family issues that they were born into, then they won't have the skills to be able to handle those same issues that will come up in other people. Because like I said, it's not that when you look at a person and you say that's how their personality is and that's just how they are, that they're never going to meet another person in their life that may have the same type of principles and values. Yeah, the faces change, but the principles and the values often remain the same. And if you have no tolerance for dealing with it in your own family and being able to bring closure to it, you're not going to have the skills and the tolerance to bring closure to that with somebody who's outside of the family. So that's very, very important to check out how a person is able to handle and deal with and navigate the type of things that are disagreeable with them with the family that they were born into, because, like I said, that represents their first training unit. And if they're not mastering or having the ability to deal with those things on this level, what makes you think they're going to step up and be able to deal with those things on the next level with the same type of issues when somebody's bringing it to the table that they're not necessarily going to be connected to for the rest of their life, whether they call them a husband, wife, or whatever? You can easily walk away from that if you're easily able to walk away from it with your own physical family. So that's very, very important, because just because a person steps off from a physical family, they say they don't deal with that person no more, they don't talk to this person, that, and the third, it doesn't necessarily mean that they are not still under the influence of that upbringing and those social circumstances. Because like I said, you can say you're going to step off from family. You can say you're not talking to this person for the rest of your life, but since you were born into it, they're going to be family for the rest of your life, whether you want to acknowledge it or not. And because you come from the same gene pool, or you might have been raised in a circumstance where you share the same socioeconomic gene pool, meaning you might have been adopted, you may have been raised over here, this, that, and the third, there are still things that are common to that environment that you were shaped and molded in. So it doesn't matter if you go and move over to Alaska or if you're over here in Atlanta, you're still bringing along with you those influences that shape the dynamic that the family that you were in. So it's very, very important to check that out. Very, very important to check that out, because people will bring that with them to the relationship that you want to potentially start with them. So just wanted to share that. Hope it was helpful. And keep in mind, always study family dynamics. Not only your own is where it starts, but also that of a potential companion or friend or associate or whatever, because they're going to bring that along with them. Peace.
Welcome, all. Welcome, all. As you know, we're back again live. Greetings to all of our beloved BTR family, and welcome to another Wednesday edition of Let's Talk with Mr. Talk. Aaron Jackson won't be joining us today, so I hope you guys don't mind me filling in temporarily. This is Cloud Nation, broadcasting live and direct. Today's show is entitled Family Structure, Foundation Building, and Distinguishing Roles. You guys may have known yesterday we started to get into this real quickly, and we launched the series off talking about family dynamics. And in that particular episode, we entitled Family Dynamics incubators of consciousness, which is a belief of mine that our family units, our family structures, the family values, all those things are founding blocks. And they are the incubators of our consciousness. You just got through listening to previously with Hill Harper, writer of Conversations, and several other books. Also a well-known buddy of the president. We all know that by now. But one of my favorites was the last brother, who's not as well known, was Brother Saladin Allah from Atlantis Build, a nonprofit organization, speaking directly on family dynamics. As I said, today's show is entitled Family Structure, Foundation Building, and Distinguishing Roles. So if you're interested in chiming in, have something on your mind you want to talk about, just based on the stuff you heard already, or you just want to share your perspective, don't hesitate to chime in. The number is 347-838-8622. That, again, is 347-838-8622. Press number 1 to talk, and we will open up the mics and the lines for you to do what you need to do. So we've already listened to some of the pre-recorded pieces and sound bites. And so we're gonna look at a few professional opinions, scholarly opinions on family structure. We also have we dug back in the way back the way back machine to pull out W.E.B. Du Bois, Sociology of the African American Family. Yes, and so I definitely wanna talk about that, and you know, we also started off with some insight from a few psychologists and sociologists who spoke on the family in general and the American family specifically. Also, we're going to incorporate the global structure and dynamics of families all across the world. We're going to really start to dice and dig into a variety of different ideas and concepts that exist around the world. So we're not going to limit things. We're going to definitely touch on a variety of different things. As I said before, we have all week, so we'll be dibbling in and out. But one of the most concentrated portions of today's show will really focus heavily on the foundation. And we know in the foundation of a family, typically it starts off with a man and a woman who procreate children, become an extension of that family long term. So when we look at the foundation, it was very necessary that we listen to Brother Saladin Allah and his perspective on family dynamics, because it really, really touches and hits home when it comes to talking about the foundation. Now, we know every family has its own needs, and I'm a firm believer, and this is just my opinion personally based on some of the teaching I received, is that every family needs a vision, you know, and, you know, a clearly defined framework as a map to navigate each invested member towards the big picture goals of the whole. You know, wealth creation, for example, isn't some accidental anomaly, but in fact, for many, it's a strategically crafted, well-calculated goal and initiative. So when we look at the family, family dynamics and family values, as we did yesterday, I think that it's that we should also consider, you know, how well thought out the structure of that family is, the vision of that family is. Because speaking just from a using terminology from the investment and finance area, typically, you know, vision is very, very significant when it comes to family. I'm going to use a working definition from the finance area of family, and we're going to get into it more in depth here soon. So family, according to their definition, is two or more individuals who either because of bonds of affinity or because of genetic or emotional linkage think of themselves as related to each other. Now, I just wanted to use that particular definition for the moment. And we're going to dig into some more terms and thoughts and ideologies and so forth. I see we do have a caller who wants to chime in, so I'm going to open up his mic right now. Caller, you live?
Hey, what's up, brother? It's Michigan.
Hey, how you doing, Michigan?
Yeah, I'm pretty good. Yeah, I was listening to your conversation. You know, and I agree with you when you say the family is the, how they say, the incubator of consciousness. But now, you know, what I've learned is that there's, you know, many types of, you know, consciousness. You know what I'm saying? Whether it be, you can be conscious about something politically, something social. So I don't think that there's no universal consciousness. Now, I said that to say this. As far as I'm concerned, the black family in this day and age, they must have a certain type of consciousness that would help us, you know, kind of specifically political, that would help us navigate. So now, adding that to what the clip with the brother said, you know, that type of consciousness, that type of political consciousness is not innate. You know what I'm saying? It has to be taught. So let's say that the two adults who are getting together, let's say that they don't have that type of political consciousness that is necessary for the black family, then certainly, you know, they couldn't pass that down to the offspring. Now, and a lot of the scholars that I hear you using just talk in general about relationships, which is certainly necessary. But I would suggest there's several I know people like the word Pan-African, but I'll use it anyway. Pan-African scholars and psychologists who speak on relationships, that they're going to give you a different view of relationships between Africans because they're Pan-African. So they're going to give you a perspective that you won't get just, say, from going to a counselor, you know, a general counselor or an American counselor or just your grandmother. So I just wanted to throw that piece in there that, you know, even when we're talking about relationships, it's hard for me to separate my political ideology even from relationships. And so I think that we should keep that in mind as we're talking about, you know, trying to build a relationship amongst blacks. And to me, just having a general understanding of how a relationship works won't necessarily give us the correct political consciousness as well as how we spend our money, you know, like you said, goal setting, And that's a good point, too, having a family vision. Again, I don't believe that no African family vision, if they have a vision, should be separate from their or not included the current state of politics that the black family would find themselves in. I don't see how you can separate them. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, a black family just can't have they could have a general vision, but to me it needs to be linked to real-time situation and where we find ourselves. I think if we don't, then I think that's how you produce. You ever heard a child say, or a grown person say, well, I don't care where I spend my money, as long as I'm getting where I want. I know that everybody's heard black people say that. Well, again, to me, you said an incubator consciousness, that's because they don't have a certain type of political consciousness that helps them see that in this day and age is a foolish statement as it relates to the politics that's on the ground. I don't care where I spend my money, as long as I get what I want. You understand what I'm saying? So I know Amos Wilson, he's got a lot of YouTube videos on relationships. There's a couple of others, and if I could think of them, I'll chime back in and let you know who their names are. But you're going to get the definition of relationship, particularly African relationships, from a Pan-Africanist or a African, it doesn't have to be Pan-African, from an African-centered point of view. And I think that's very important. So I'll mute myself and keep listening.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, and I'm very familiar with Dr. Amos Wilson. I'm very familiar with, Brother Umar Johnson. Definitely familiar with the readings and the writings of Marcus Garvey and there are some others that I got to bring up, whose clips pertaining to this specific endeavor. Didn't have really the time to dig up everybody, unfortunately, but I just wanted to keep it general and really rely on the contribution of people, you know, of our peers to really bring in their wisdom and their knowledge, people such as yourself who can give us working definitions, real life examples, and personalized experiences that will confirm a lot of those things. Because I was telling people yesterday, as we use some of the recordings that we would use, we might take bits and pieces out of it, but in some cases, some of the sound bites were from conflicting views, you know, views that we didn't agree with or I didn't agree with in some cases at all. But I like to keep open it up so people can kind of, you know, look at a variety of different thought processes and pretty much free people up to, like, basically make their own decision, so to speak. Because what, for me personally, what I often found out is that, you know, sometimes when we give them our input, that doesn't always go well. Like if you give them, if it's all or nothing, so to speak. But if you give them a variety of different options, and sometimes people are conscious enough to choose the better option, and you didn't have to force them to do it, but they decided to do it. Choose the right option. So I totally agree with you. You know, definitely have to use more of the conscious-minded examples of information. But I thought that those were, they were, like you said, good general. They're pretty general, pretty vague. You know, they weren't, they didn't really break it down to specifics. But I I had to put together what I could in a time frame, especially with the videos. And also, I wanted to make sure that the length of the videos were a little shorter too, which was a little challenging when it came to getting some of the guys that I'm sure you're referring to, who some of their videos are like, man, you know, I think about Amos Wilson alone. You know, some of their videos are pretty long, and you have to really chop through it. So it was hard to chop through that while, you know, focusing on other responsibilities, unfortunately, at the same time. But I'm definitely going to work on, you know, getting that content out there so that people can get access to it as well. And one of the interesting examples of variations, I guess, of families and, you know, family concepts and structures was a, I guess you could say, more of a sociologist type of setting, where they looked at different structures and how people made those choices globally. One of the things that was interesting to me within those, examining some of these global states of the family, we get a chance to look at a few of some of the basic concepts that some people use to characterize the diversity in family structures and process, even at a micro sociological level. Many of the families and their social institutions present in a variety of different human societies. So to fulfill, you know, different functions in a variety of ways, a few of the examples I think Ellen Leder was talking about were obviously, you know, you have procreation. She talked about socialization. She talked about regulation of sexual behavior, which is interesting that was in there. She talked about division of labor, economic provision for members, affective and emotional needs, and, you know, status-given properties. And at a more micro-sociological level, they talked about a family unit and a group of people sharing a relationship based on biology, marriage, or adoption, and who fulfill the functions as we just listed, and who usually live together, individuals living together regardless of their relationship or whether they fulfill common social functions, constitute a household. They also talked about individuals usually belonging to two types of families, a family of orientation in which one is born and raised, and a family of procreation created by marriage and having or adopting children. Depending on the number of generations sharing a household, you know, many distinguish between what they call nuclear family, or which is the household composed of parents and children, and extended family, which is usually a family unit comprising additional relatives such as grandparents, siblings, cousins, kinship, and all those things. So without getting super, super boring, because, you know, we'll get back to that part, that component. What I find interesting is that when you look at the foundation, in the genesis of many relationships, I think Michigan was definitely right. When two are coming together, you know, there are a variety of different concepts, ideologies, that viewpoints that you're bringing to the table. in my opinion, you know, in order to work in harmony collectively in a family unit, not saying everybody has to be lemmings, but I think it's necessary that the family embraces and stay on par with a particular ideology, a particular vision. Well, I'm just going to leave it there, because we, without breaking all the different ones down. So that vision, like you guys were talking about, is so important when it comes to politics, economics, core values, you know, your principles, you know, your morale, all those things, your level of consciousness, like he said, should definitely be cohesive. And generally, oftentimes, what we witness collectively, and when you look at at families, all in a variety of different places around the world, but let's look at in America, right, for the moment. Traditionally, I don't like that word. In many cases, what we've seen, or what many of us have probably witnessed, is that the thought process, or the planning process of establishing a family and building a foundation is, for many, not all, but for many people, the planning process is very, very, how can I put it? It's a process that many people overlook. I'm going to say that, and I think that's why we possibly get into the things like the divorce rate, for example, for those who do get married, but also the dysfunctionality that's witnessed where both parties, meaning the parents, aren't equally participating in the building and the development of the family and its vision. And I don't know if it's, you know, because I'm leaning on you guys for assistance. I don't know if it's because many of us operate more on our emotions, or if how we look at planning out, you know, the family vision and the foundation of the family, laying that out. I don't know if that's just something many people don't discuss when it comes to the very idea of courtship, or is it that people really just don't talk about courting at all? You know, and I know that's an old school word, and I know that some people are like, man, if you're a young guy talking about courting, yes. I'm still talking about courting. But yes, that whole process of courting or procreation in general, you know, creating another life form together, you would think that would be planned out, well planned out, and that the two parties coming together would intentionally plan that process out early on to late, or even if not early on, somewhere in the genesis stage of the development of the family. And for some reason, maybe it's just me, maybe it's just some things I've encountered and witnessed, but it seems like for some, that process is typically a last minute or a delayed decision, or a decision that never happens because you have two coming together who find out over time they're really not on the same page. And so the vision, the family vision, is really non-existent. Now, I want to look at I'm going to look at something that W.E.B. Du Bois stated, because I don't want to keep rambling and just saying, some nonsense. You know. But I just want to look at something that he discussed briefly. I'm not a W.E.B. Du Boisite or anything like that, but I came across this information and I thought, okay, interesting. And so I always like to look at different people's ideas, because keep in mind, I am not that familiar with the sociology of the African-American family on the basis of the paradigm of W.E.B. Du Bois. So some of this stuff for me is definitely when it comes to talking about certain people's ideas. More familiar with people like Amos Wilson, but or Dr. Kwanzaa Kujufu, but not exactly W.E.B. Du Bois. So he talked about the family and that how is one of society's core institutions. And, many of what we call sociologists have studied, the family by addressing various aspects of the family unit, like its structure and members' roles. So the study of the African-American family specifically, in their minds, in many's minds, is complex with debates, raising as to what structure a family should resemble, the specific roles of family members, and the social functions of the family for its members in the large society. So basically, it's a lot similar to some issues that a variety of different people do tackle in general. Now, during his early sociological period, I believe it was 1897 to 1914, and if I'm not mistaken, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote extensively about African-American quality of life, as he put it, and specifically to address issues impacting the African-American family. He took an empirical, scientific approach in his attempt to document African-American family life at the turn of the 20th century. Now, he consistently argued that inequality was grounded in social structures that could be changed. And as a social scientist, he worked to promote change by empirically documenting the, as he put it, the Negro problems and addressing the African-American community's continued limited access to accepted social norms regarding family life. So, however, it appears that Du Bois let his impatience with the African-American population's inability to quickly emerge from their history of social degradation to infuse his writings. So there is a subtle bias towards the upper class throughout his writings, which may have, prevented Du Bois from being able to fully appreciate the values and survival tactics of the larger community he was studying to many. But while the sociological community, has largely overlooked the significance of his work, I would imagine, Du Bois implemented the most scientific in-depth studies, in many's opinions, on the African-American community and the African-American family at the time. So Du Bois' methodological approach utilized, everything from in-depth ethnographic studies to empirical research. So in his words, Du Bois attempted to bring awareness of what he called the Negro problems to the public with what he considered as facts. And this allowed him to promote structural reforms which would enable families of all races to be able to fulfill their respective roles and functions successfully within the larger society, in his opinion. So in 1896, Du Bois embarked on a 16-month study of the everyday life of African Americans residing in Philadelphia's 7th Ward. His findings were published in 1899 as the Philadelphia Negro, a Social Study. Now, this extensive study, it covered population and migration patterns, housing conditions, social life, health care issues, crime, religion, and family life. Now, here Du Bois combined what people call a quantitative or qualitative and a qualitative methodology approach to document African-American quality of life within the Seventh Ward. And later, I believe, in Atlanta University, Du Bois hosted he edited many of the reports of the annual Atlantic University conferences. And each year, the conference would focus on a different aspect of African-American life. The Negro American Family of 1909 is of a particular interest, as Du Bois addressed such topics as family structure and functions, the home, economics, and the daily life of African Americans. Now, I know I'm definitely going to have to bring some counter information here, so, but during this same time period, you know, Du Bois was, he was researching, he also researched and published rural and urban small area social studies that included discussions of family life. Those studies included, you know, documents like the Black North in 1901, a social study that he wrote, the Negroes of Daugherty County, Georgia, and the Negroes of Farmville, Virginia, a social study, all part of his text. So Du Bois took issue with the highly theoretical approaches to the study of social phenomena that were popular at that particular time. In fact, he specifically reacted to Hubert Spencer and his synthetic philosophy, calling it verbal jugglery, which Du Bois argued led to an abstract descriptive sociology that could not be verified empirically. So these car window or armchair sociologies, as he put it, try to study and understand the African-American social situation from a distance without directly observing African-American life. Now, he accused his contemporaries of trying to comprehend the Negro problems from the office, as he criticized the work of sociologists like Franklin Giddings and Herbert Spencer, Green and Driver, 1978, for example. Du Bois also argued that social scientists were focusing more on theory and scientific laws rather than empirically addressing relevant social issues. Now, Du Bois argued for the need to move toward more measurement and less abstract theorizing. A more scientific approach would allow the social science to study the members of a family as human beings living in concrete reality rather than as abstractions. So social norms and values, as he put it, help maintain balance and social standards within a society. If an acceptable standard is not longer held by the majority of the population, that society would experience disorganization, according to Du Bois. So he perceived the Negro problems as linked to the fact that American society no longer had an accepted standard of norms and values for all its members. And his belief was that the American elites and their norms and values of family life have been held out as an idea for African Americans. And during the period of slavery, African Americans were taught to accept these norms, but they were prevented from practicing them. Thus, in the decades following emancipation, society was witnessing the emergence of the African American family from decades of structured social degradation. So in his researching the Negro problems, Du Bois sought to prove that inequality was grounded in structures that could be changed, thus enabling him to be able to propose change and reform. Attempting to provide a balanced approach to a study of the Negro problems, Du Bois would often begin each work with a look at life in Africa before slavery was utilized as a means of deculturation and I believe social control. So this approach served as a tool for comparing life before and after slavery in order to document progress. And Du Bois concluded many of his studies with the final words section. And this section in particular often included a call to action and served as a reminder of the duty of African Americans and of whites to ensure that their communities would address the issues at hand. So Du Bois urged African Americans to take ownership of their current situation and to improve their communities themselves personally and not to wait on the elite. He also had a special emphasis, which was placed on the roles of families and removing any hindrances that prevented family members from functioning successfully with American society. Now, this particular approach, he demonstrated in both the Philadelphia Negro and the Negro American Family writings by employing a triangular methodology that integrated survey research, and the analysis of available census data. Du Bois sought to empirically document his findings. So doing so, Du Bois was attempting to promote public awareness of the African American family's problems, and his hope was that this would lead to social reform. And if this were to take place, the family, in his opinion, would be able to fulfill its respective roles and functions successfully within the society. Now, according to Du Bois, when studying the family, one must decide which structures will be included in the analysis. So Du Bois was confronted with this dilemma. In conducting the work for the Philadelphia Negro, he encountered many different groups of relations living together. So in the Negro American family, Du Bois remarked that few modern groups, his words, not mine, show a greater internal differentiation of social conditions than the Negro American, and the failure to realize this is the case of much confusion. Now, Du Bois began his studies of African American family life in Philadelphia by looking at family size. Average household size for African American families residing in the 7th Ward in 1896 was 5.08 persons, according to the census definition of family. However, Du Bois maintained that actual family size was really only 3.18 persons. So the census family measured all those individuals living within the household, including lodgers or renters, whereas the actual family consisted of husband and wife, children, and or other blood relatives. That's an interesting thing. I think that's a significant thing to note when we're looking at some of the research and the data that we get from a variety of different sources. That's why you got to check your source, obviously. So Du Bois prefer, you know, that latter measure. And he described the African-American residents of Philadelphia 7th Ward as a ward of lodgers and sojourners, newly married couples settle down here until they are compelled by the appearance of children to move into homes of their own. in the Farmville, Virginia study, the rural counterpart to the Philadelphia study, Du Bois encountered many of the same issues regarding family structure. Now, Du Bois maintained that question of the size of African-American families is important, but difficult to determine on account of the varying meanings of the word family. So only one generation from slavery, Du Bois described what he termed gradations of family structures, namely, number one, possible family, i.e., the parents and all children ever born to them living, and number two, the real family, i.e., the parents and all children living at parent at present, and number three, the economic family, i.e., all persons related and unrelated living in one home under conditions of family life. So apparently, Du Bois decided that the actual family or the traditional nuclear family was the preferred family structure, as this family structure remained his ideal for the African-American family. Now, when addressing white families, Du Bois focused on the economic family or census family. Here, you know, Du Bois also addressed the difficulties faced by actual families and how they become economic families in order to survive financially. However, Du Bois does not explain why he utilizes one family measure for African Americans and another for whites. In fact, at the time Du Bois was writing, economic circumstances greatly influenced the size and the structure of families. Both mothers and fathers had to work outside of the home, leaving the children largely unattended in urban and rural settings. So in these cities, bigger families meant an increased need for necessities such as space, clothing, and food. And due to the lack of good-paying jobs and limited employment options in the city and rural communities, fathers often had to relocate in order to live closer to their place of employment. Sounds real familiar, right? For this to be history, that information sounds a lot similar to what we're talking about today. So consequently, these fathers were only able to join their families once or twice a week. Mothers who went to work to help bring in financial resources often relied on extended family members living with them, e.g. grandmother, to help raise the children. This living arrangement impacted household size, the socialization of children, and family dynamics. So by being the center for education, social life, and intense moral training, Du Bois felt that the family should have had a tremendous impact on African-American life. However, with dual earners in the household, Du Bois was concerned that children were not receiving appropriate adult supervision and nurturing. That's an interesting perspective. He also believed that the breakdown of the African-American family was also a result of slavery and its continuing legacy. However, Du Bois failed to appreciate the resilience of the African-American family as extended family members continued to assist in meeting the emotional and economic needs of various family units. So, you know, I think, you know, some of his, you know, Du Bois' perspective, if nothing else, is definitely quite interesting. I mean, you know, I'll definitely give it that. It's definitely something that makes you say, hmm. So with all that information, because that was a whole lot of stuff to spew out there, one of the things that comes to my mind specifically in this particular case is I find it interesting that Du Bois on the African American family but I found it interesting that he, in my opinion, kind of boxed kind of box the family in to one concept that he preferred. And I'm not knocking that at all. I just found it interesting that particular perspective for Du Bois was what it was. It was interesting. So when we look at the family, right, and we talk about the relationship between men and women, that's the foundation. That's the beginning, in my opinion. And so when those two come together, the planning out, the laying out the structure, the vision, laying out the vision of the family is very significant. If maybe you guys agree, I don't know. But don't hesitate to chime in at any time. Remember, the call-in number is 347-838-8622. Press button number 1 to share your perspective. That, again, is 347-838-8622. Don't hesitate to press button number 1 if you want to chime in at any time. And so I personally believe, like I said, in my opinion, I found that quite interesting. I found the perspective to be interesting. I found the fact that there was one particular family that he structure that he identified as interesting. And I want to name off a few things that we talked about yesterday, because we looked at some of the symptoms, and we were attempting to, look at and diagnose what could potentially be what some may call, a dysfunctional family or a broken family. So we talked about, being broken, wounded, traumatized, or scarred for life, so to speak. And so when we think about two people coming together, because like I said, that's the foundation of building a family. It starts, that's the genesis. I start to think of things that people brought up yesterday, stuff like governing of behavior, principle values, core beliefs, things like that. Modeling behavior, what you're teaching each other, what you're modeling, and how we set the bar as examples for our children, as we set a standard that they can use, a benchmark for governing their behavior. We also talked about economic and social changes and their impacts, their impact on the family and the evolution of the family and the various family dynamics and values and how they figure in. We also discussed, things like the functions families serve, and how families are, how do you design your family to meet the needs of each member. But one of the things that we didn't bring up, and I want to bring up today, is something that I appreciate not just then, but I appreciate now. In fact, I rely on it on this show, and that is a very, very overlooked nugget, overlooked, I don't want to say currency, but a very valuable asset to the family unit. And that is the value of elders, the value of those who came before us, who know way more than we know, who have, the life experiences, who have the acquired knowledge that goes beyond our comprehension. I mean, just like how Brother Michigan shared his wisdom and insight, and he does this a lot to try to keep me on task. I'm sure I frustrate him a lot because I sometimes don't come in here as prepared as I should have, especially on something, a topic that is significant and is as critical as this particular topic. And so I appreciate, you know, all the elders that, that bring in the wisdom and insight. And I think, you know, when you look at, you know, the evolution of families and you look at some of the dynamics in some of our families, you know, yes, of yesteryear and today, for me personally, when I look at and when I think about the privileges and the blessings and basically the benefit of me living in growing up in a community that is deemed as a pretty rough community in the city of Chicago, Inglewood, was where I grew up. I was surrounded by elders. You know, every family on my block specifically had elders in their family. Every house, every building was full of what I call wisdom, of walking, talk, living, breathing wisdom, period. It's the spirit and the nature of it. You know, those who can remind us and help us to reflect and tap into our ancestry, those who can bring us and connect us with a variety of different books and information and stuff to research that deals with our history. It was because of the elders that caused me to have to be prepared, because I knew I was going to be quizzed on some things, and so I had to read a lot of different things. And it was very important that I had it right when I would encounter an elder on the block. And if I got into any mischief and an elder called me out on it, I knew right then and there that there was definitely going to be some discipline taking place, not just there, but when I got home too, that I was going to definitely catch it. And so, the significance of elders is so important. And I'm going to open up the mic of Chef Rob, because I've been rambling on and on. And I see that he pressed button number one. So I open up your mic.
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, I got you. My fault, man. I'm in the middle of a couple of projects here, so it's going to be kind of noisy. But, yeah, I heard the last part when you were talking about the elders. I know you come from Inglewood.
Yes, sir. 7204 South Emerald, to be exact. Yes, sir.
So right now, what I'm doing something over there on 69th and Emerald, that big building right there. I'm helping a couple of brothers that's over there doing some stuff. And you were talking about the elders, because my grandmother still lives on 68 and Lafton, right? So when I go over there, I don't see the elders on that street no more. I don't see that wisdom and that knowledge.
Exactly.
And I don't see that, hey, boy, get on away from there. I'm going to tell you. So I don't see that. I see a lot of middle-aged to young people around. I don't see the elders coming out really sitting outside like they used to, because I used to come over there in that neighborhood and hang out, and my grandparents been living there for years. And that's a big problem. I see a lot of young people more, and it seems like each group I see coming up, it seems like they hate that older generation and got a whole lot of silly jokes and nonsense. I go to work, and there's a young man in there, and like everybody's pretty much in their late 30s, 40s, and 50s, 60s, a couple of 70s, well, one person in his 70s. But he's like in his early 20s, like 26, 25. And he's constantly running through there talking about, oh, you old people this, you old people that, you old people. And like he said, man, if it weren't for these old people, your stupid self wouldn't even have this job. It's a whole lot of disrespect there and a whole lot of disconnect with a whole lot of young people. And if they don't go ahead and respect the elders that's close by, it's hard to even teach them about their own history, because they want to stick with that nonsense and garbage. They think that's reality. That's fact. We got some serious issues, man, and it's hard to go ahead and break that chain, because this this ain't just no one, two generations. I think this go back four or five generations, how we gotten so stupid. And it just don't seem like it's getting better. It seems like it's getting worse. And we got a lot of people, and again, too much disrespect to that, all that wisdom and knowledge and that experience and what they went through. And I just don't, I don't get it personally. And please enlighten me. If you see anything that I said that's wrong, let me know.
No, I think you're totally right. It's been some time. It's been a while since I've been there. I'm opening up Brother Michigan's mic as well. It's been a while since I've been back because, you know, there were some organizations over there that I attempted to connect with and work with, and they seem to be, you know, on point. But what I've encountered is that, you know, that it has to be brothers like yourself who are either from the neighborhood, who like really have stock in the neighborhood, who really, really are actually about the business of improving the communities, where some, many of those groups just want to collect the government dollars, and they want to pretend and put up the facade as though they really care about the community. So for me, you know, it's hard to even, go there at times, because, you know, I don't frequent it, but because of like you said, because it's a totally different place, because many of the elders either passed away and some of their young people inherited it, or they just, you know, moved away, left the city and went back to the South in many cases. So pretty much most of the people that when I was there, I would say 90% are gone. There may be 10%, and that might be being nice, but maybe 1%. It might be one or two people still there. I don't know. But the majority of them, I know personally, because we knew everybody, they're gone. So.
Yeah, and see, the information you was putting out about W.E.B. Du Bois, you know, I knew a little bit about them, but some of the stuff I did know about it. And a lot of them, we don't go ahead and have that way of showing that connection to show how positive that is, that we need to go ahead and have that information, because you were talking about him doing the studies of the family, and we need that. So, hold on, brother. I need to take care of
something. Hey, Carl, this is Michigan. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'm listening.
I'm just going to give you a funny example about the importance of the elders. So we was the school district, it was a black superintendent. He was pretty open-minded. And so I made a rough school district. So what happened, someone had made the suggestion that we needed to get the, can you hear me?
Am I still loud and clear?
Okay.
Yeah, we got it.
To get the grandparents, right, involved in the school district. You know, you have the parent advisory council. But someone had made a suggestion that we needed to get the grandparents involved in the school system process. So I don't know who came up with the idea, but somebody came up with the idea to make the grandparents hall monitors in the high school. I mean, and paid them. You know, they weren't just volunteering, but he paid them. Man, do you know? When he put those, all they did, brother, they was hall monitors. So you know what a hall monitor just walks up and down. You know, after when you're switching classes, you know, they just walk them down the hall, just kind of keep an eye on things. Zero tardiness, zero fighting, and zero skipping. That's what the numbers went to when he put those grandparents in the hallways. Now, of course, that got shut down. But, you know, just giving you that phenomena of the power that those grandparents had. And, you know, I observed them, you know, telling them young brothers, hey, pull your pants up. Or, girl, get to that class. And so it was monitored for about 6 to 8 months. Zero tardiness, zero fightings, and the percentage rate of skipping went down to zero. Now, explain that.
it's like you said, it's that valuable, you know, asset. I mean, I think, you know, some, you know, there are some people who assume that the elders are too tough, or that there's this conflict between, you know, young and the elder, and I think there are moments where you may have some people who misunderstand elders or things like that. But for the most part, like you said, the value you can just look at the history of neighborhoods, and maybe I need to do that my own research and study on it. But I believe that if you can trace in any neighborhood a community where there's a sizable percentage of elders on that block, in that neighborhood, most likely that neighborhood is usually, from my personal experience, the quietest, calmest, most peaceful, sensible neighborhood in that block. No matter what the tax bracket is, whenever you find, you know, neighborhoods that has a concentration of elders, typically, and I'm not talking about those people who are part of a cycle of ignorance, because, you know, there's a group of those that could be older, but they just didn't get it. But more times than not, if you have an elderly presence, if you have a presence of elders in your community, it's significant. It's very significant in your neighborhood, and it makes a big difference. And there are some neighborhoods here that are considered very affluent, and it's a drastic difference between the blocks where you have a huge percentage of elders there versus the neighborhoods where you might have even the young professionals. I mean, the peace and the peace and the noise alone is tremendously different. And these are so-called affluent communities. So there's a big difference. There's a big difference because I believe, you know, when you have elders in that gift, that asset in your neighborhood, you know, the knowledge, the wealth of knowledge and wisdom that they bring is not only unmeasurable, but the impact that naturally they have on people, because it's just who they are. It's so significant, it fills a lot. They fill a lot of voids. Like I said, you know, growing up in a single mother home, you know, I got a chance to witness manhood from other elderly males. Because they were there. So it was a big difference from being a guy who may have grown up in a house full of women, you know, where no elders were present, or being a young guy who grew up without a connection to any elders. It would be totally different. And as a kid, for me personally, I learned to draw to the elders' discussion. Like, you know, I knew that the kids, the people my age, this is how I looked at it as a kid. People my age, when it came to playtime, find the kids. But when you wanted to learn something or know anything about life, pull up a seat and just listen to their discussion. And I promise you, it was like preaching to the choir every time for me sitting down wherever the elders were, because for some reason, whenever they would talk, it was as if they were talking to me, not preaching at me, because they would be having their own discussion as if I wasn't there. And they would have talk about life situations. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I did want to, you had talked about the boys using the one particular model for family. What specifically, I didn't really catch, what specifically were you talking about? You were surprised that he used the one model. What was that?
Yeah, his model is the model we call the social I mean, the nuclear family model, like the Mary standard nuclear family model. That was that, which is a traditional model here in the colonized version of America. So that was the preferred model according to Du Bois. So that's a significant one. I didn't feel like it was a bad thing necessarily. I just found that interesting that he came to that conclusion for the African American family, but his conclusion for the white families or other families was a lot more flexible. He was more flexible when it came to people, and maybe it's because he is a part of the African American family. I don't know, but I just found it quite interesting.
The other thing about we say a universal model or things of that nature. One of the things that I've noticed is that, for the most part, America does not use African. We can even say African. They don't really use African American scholarship, other than you'll see a little bit, most of it being used in, say, your African-centered study, courses within the colleges. But for the most part, and I could be wrong if somebody knows anything different, American institutions, they don't use black scholarship as a teachable, They don't use it at textbooks or things of that nature. But
hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Can you hear me?
Yeah,
hello?
We can
hear you.
Okay.
I didn't know you had the
mic open earlier, so I wasn't sure if you told us you had to step away for a second, so I didn't know to open it up for you.
Yeah, I did. I want to address something real quick. Yeah, I really think they use what the African American scholars go ahead and put out there, and they use it as part of their marketing strategy to go ahead and deal with black folks to sell them stuff. Okay, the more their mindset, the more they understand about our roots and our history, the more they can go ahead and sell us a lot of garbage and nonsense, and go ahead and keep on having.
I would agree from that perspective, but what I was getting at was, We tend to look for some, like I said, universal definition of family. We want to cherry pick from other cultures, but we tend to shy away from African scholars who have spent their life developing these theories with an Afrocentric mind. And so I was, from that perspective, meaning you probably couldn't find one university that has in its, say, in the class of sociology, that one book written by an African-centered scholar, a doctor, in sociology, in a major university, I bet you couldn't find one book written by an African scholar that's used in that university as part of the curriculum. Now, see, why is that? You're talking about, these brothers and sisters, if they call themselves Americans, they're American scholars, but you won't see their work or their perspective used as the norm, which you would assume that's universities, they pick the norm. And so, I guess I was just trying to connect that to, what we use as African people, as our models of family and things of that nature, why we tend to not want to use the documentation and the information that's put together by African scholars. Now, I remember, Claude, earlier you said, well, I like to give people, give them all that, give them a taste of everything, and kind of let them make their own. Well, I understand that, but I'm not talking directly to you, but, I heard you say that. But, most cultures don't do that. An Asian culture don't say, well, just tell them about everything and then let them feel. Latinos, you know, or even Europeans. See, they don't use us, right? They don't use our information. I mean, they don't like Chef Rob said, but they use it so that they can know you, so they can make some money off you, free market capitalism. But as far as how you structure a family, the role of a woman or the role of a man, they don't. They could give a damn what an African scholar, you know, things of that nature. But why do we always pick up their shit? I mean, that's kind of puzzling. The way you guys can answer that.
No, that makes perfect sense. Actually, I like that old African proverb. You know, it takes a village to raise a child, or another
and
one of my favorite. Don't tear
that.
Down a don't tear down a fence until you know why it was put up. I appreciate the wisdom. I appreciate the wisdom because I totally agree. I guess the reason why, and I'm sure it's not justifiable. I think the reason why I took that method was I don't know. Sometimes when from my personal encounters, you know, when I would present a specific model, you know, it would have backlash unless, you know, it was set up like a black male class or something like that in that type of setting where people enroll specifically to get whatever you teach, and so you determine the curriculum. But sometimes when in a media format, it's been, you know, some people have, you know, different thoughts on that. So I guess I was trying to present the information of a variety of different viewpoints, and then kind of, you know, just let people choose, so to speak.
Well, we make a lot of bad decisions and bad choices. So, and it seems like the worst decisions and the worst choices that we make, the more people welcome in. Oh, that's it. No, man. You know, some things need to be called out. And I agree with what Michigan was saying. Excuse me. For the most part, you don't have them. I do think they use part of what some of these black scholars go ahead and put out to go ahead and do, for, like I said earlier, for marketing purposes. But I think they do use it a little bit to go ahead and deal with our psyche on a few other things, and maybe go ahead and rob our works and go ahead and put their name to it and make it seem like, okay, well, because you just brought up that thing about it takes a village. I mean, how many times you hear, especially Europeans, passing that phrase around? And we have to go ahead and try to go ahead and own up to a lot of our own stuff. And a lot of us don't want to go ahead and do that. We want to go ahead and accept what people tell us who we are instead of going ahead and finding out who we are. And that's wrong.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I was looking at something I pulled up from one of the Pan-Africanist accounts, and this particular definition for they had a definition for marriage. I was still trying to find tools that's focused directly on specifically on family, not so much is the marriage component yet. For some reason, I'm having a hard time finding that. I got online, so I'm going to have to go into my books. But I'm just going to use this working example, which I found interesting. And it talked about defining marriage. So I want to use that since we were talking about the genesis of the family, the man and the woman coming together. And what procreation leads to, you know, the start of the family, in a sense. So, according to the definition they have, I'm going to read it as they stated it. It says, when you look around the history of human civilization and see the tradition of marriage that stands independent of time, race, geography, and culture, it means it is a fact of civilization, humanity,
human culture, marriage historically has been used in political unions between nations, between different ethnic groups, to secure peace, trade, and development. And marriage is one thing that unites African culture. Although two marriages will never be similar, you can marry in a church, a mosque, in the bush, by a priest, an imam, a minister of justice, underwater in a tree. The core thing is marriage is a contract of commitment with rules and regulations that represent the person's culture. It is a communal relationship, a rite of passage which bonds two people and enshrines obligations and values. And even while people may get divorced, they are guidelines and ethics in every culture for governing all aspects of married life. Marriage is dignity and a true sign of commitment. It defines our humanity and contributes to making us more human. It is exclusively between naturally God, man, members of the opposite sex. So what I want to get you guys input on that work and definition of marriage and see what you guys kind of think about that.
Real quick, Brother Michigan, I have been hearing, and I briefly saw, and it was spent some time marriage, because you was talking about, I think you mentioned in this piece about marriage, about going ahead and joining different villages or something like that. I saw in that same piece a few years ago that, hey, it was basically, you know, once a man marries this woman, that she becomes his property. So it was another form of slavery, which threw me back in my chair that I didn't agree with. So I just feel that, hey, look, maybe I should just go ahead and let as many women move in with me as possible and leave that marriage thing alone. Because it seems like a whole lot of problems. We're going ahead and dealing with a system. And that definition of marriage, is that where is that coming from? Where did you get that from? Is it from some European doctor? Is it from Asian doctor, African doctor? Where is that coming from?
It's actually from, I'm trying to get the exact name of the place. It's it's called Haliqua Media or Haliqua.com.
So it's Haliqua? Where is that?
I may be pronouncing that wrong, but it's AJ.
I didn't catch the tail end of what you said, Rob. I didn't catch the tail end of that. What did you say about the marriage?
The marriage is basically a woman is property to the man. You know, it was calming down wars, and that's what I read back a while back, and it was kind of feeding into something you said, or what Brother Cloud said, was it was just basically to calm fighting factions down, or to go ahead and have a thing where we can go ahead and create a bigger kingdom, so to speak. So my son marries your daughter, we go ahead and we merge up that way, and we be. The couple rule over the land, so to speak. Excuse me.
I think it's ain't no question. I think it's political. I think it could be political and spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that was my second oath, the one that I took with my wife, and for me, it was more of a, how would you say? It was an oath to the black woman, and that was right in my vows. But that was my second oath. So it was a life and death oath for me to the black woman. It was just for her. So, you know, it could have a lot of different meanings. I don't know about the property and shit. I mean, it could be some truth to that, but I don't have that perspective. But I think it's necessary. I think it's a necessary oath, but it's not this is my opinion. It's more so to the black woman than it is to your particular wife.
Mm-hmm.
If that makes any sense to you, brothers.
And you know something else. Here's something else. I heard of some people talking about marriage and the whole thing. And they were saying, hey, look, there was no love involved. You know, and so this thing about love came later. came later. And they basically said that love thing came within the last, what, damn near 100 years or less than that. So it was all about going ahead and keeping the peace, the whole marriage thing. That was what I got. I could be wrong. I don't go ahead and just do something I read. I didn't write the book on it or whatever. I'm just repeating something that I heard. So these individuals just go ahead and say, hey, look, let's just go ahead and make our kingdom, our area much bigger. First off, you two got together, and I think we can kind of see it politically. I mean, I don't think that a lot of these, like when you look at politicians in America. They brought back a whole lot of stuff from Europe, and I think a lot of these marriages are for convenience and for, they're just on paper, because the main thing makes me think about is some of them Republican types who've got married and come out later that these guys were gay. So, you know, a lot of it's all messed up and phony.
Yeah, I don't know what the divorce rate is, but, yeah, clearly, I mean, it's all screwed up now. But like I said, you know, I don't know what our condition, man. I mean, there needs to be the black man, to me, has to take some oath to the black woman. You know, that's my opinion. That was my oath. You know, that was my rites of passage. But I think it's necessary. I think marriage is necessary and is needed as much as possible within the black community, particularly now. That's my opinion.
You know, I think marriage is important, but I think that you know, because I don't know which one I should go ahead and bring up first, go ahead and keep on supporting the marriage thing, or go ahead and have a respect or have a family. One of the biggest problems is we don't have no sense of what a family really is. And Brother Cloud, you came from Inglewood, and you know some of the gangbangs that's running around that area. It hasn't changed in years, but they seem to think that another gangbanging group is that family. You can't have that same structure as no family that's going here dealing with a mother, father, or a mother and grandparents, or uncles and aunts that's in the house. It's not the same thing. But it got a little bit twisted into this whole idea of what is a family, and I think that should be a little bit more important issue than going ahead and trying to unite with someone else and you haven't got your house together.
Well, I think a lot of great input has been stated, and I agree with both of you. Actually, I think marriage is very significant in the sense that when it's done right, you know, in where when it becomes a successful union, meaning, you know, that it's done with class and respect, I think it can definitely be a very significant component and benefit to our communities. Then I also look at those who may decide not to marry for a variety of different reasons, and I look at those families who, you know, once they procreate, they've had a child, you know, but they don't want to get married, and so, you know, the family has to continue even though they decide not to partake in the union. So I think in those cases that you know, I have to look at that part too. Like, what happens with the family when they decide to opt out of the idea of marriage?
Let me cut y'all. Go ahead, bro.
Oh no, I was done. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I was gonna say, you know. And like I said, with, you know, brothers making babies, and then you have all of these houses with just these women and these babies. I mean, I don't think that's going to make for a good future as well, unless you got a whole lot of uncles. You know what I'm saying? So, and most men, you know, most men want to make babies. So, unless the baby's going to come with you. You know, if you're not going to be with the woman that you're, I mean, what's the future of that woman and that baby that you you don't want to necessarily make that commitment to. Well, what if she goes to the next brother and he says, well, yeah, I don't want to do the last thing, but I certainly want to make a baby. So now we got two. Then she goes to, you can see a cycle there. So I think if men are talking about having babies, I'm just talking about particularly now with where we're at, I don't see how the marriage option shouldn't be at least be on the table if you're talking about, you know, making some babies. That's my take on that.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Rob, did you have something to add? Because I didn't want to go in yet.
Well, you know, the sex thing, I mean, you just look at that a little bit more. And marriage, I mean, people are not really getting married because it's got some love involved in it today. But I think the whole sex thing, and why you got, you know, babies people having babies out of wedlock is because it's all sex is all about pleasure and me and me and me and me and me and me and you know, whatever that baby is. And I'm gonna be critical of a lot of guys. You know, if she get pregnant, that's her problem. That's what a lot of guys feel. She shouldn't go ahead and gave it up to me, did it so and so and so and so, and then they go ahead and they got to call her names and treat her like crap and whatever. But it took two people to make that baby, and it seemed like a lot of guys, they want to go ahead and pull their responsibility out along with their penis. And so, you know, it's a big problem with a whole lot of black folks. And it's still, and a lot of people want to go ahead and reject it, but it still go back to that slave mentality. We've never, ever truly healed from that slave mentality. And that's the bigger problem.
And, you know, I think, you know, I personally, again, I like what both of you guys were saying, because I definitely think marriage is definitely a good, you know, first option when it comes to making that decision that you want to, you know, create a family. You know, typically you would think in an ideal scenario, you decide that you two coming together are going to come together and build on a specific vision, and then you guys have to start to produce children together under the union. That's really the concept that seems to work very very well in more cases than not. But like you guys said, unfortunately, you have a lot of people who haven't, you know, embraced that idea, and so for those who don't plan it out at all, or laying out a foundation, or really decide on how they want to structure everything and plan this whole family vision and process, some of them they just, you know, it's just sex for many, and that sex leads to childbirth, and then childbirth leads to, you know, a family of sorts, you know, because they have created a child together. And so in those cases, you know, that's what I look at. That, like you said, unfortunately, there's a huge percentage of people walking down that fine line now, and a lot of guys like Robinson are opting out. They're opting out of not just marriage, but they're opting out of the lives of the sons. Now, I think the numbers may not be as accurate, in my opinion. I don't think it's the numbers might be as dire as we may see in statistics. I could be wrong. I think that I see a lot of guys who opt in to at least be fathers in many cases, but you know, I definitely think that I agree that the marriage can be the ideal. I think the challenging part with that is still the genesis, you know, because oftentimes, even when people decide to marry, you know, you bring two people together who just are not on the same page at all. And that could be destructive for a family.
Because that could create a ripple effect, and that could be cataclysmic. You know, when you bring two people together and they can't work together. You know, sometimes, you know, my granddad and my mom, they're best friends. I mean, my granddad and my grandma, they're best friends, but they're not married. they function very well together when one is living in a different household as parents. But that's just for them.
Let me tell you something real quick. My grandparents, my father's parents, right? Because I didn't really know my mom's parents. My father's parents, my grandmother, I can't remember how they got on the conversation, but anyway, my grandmother told my sisters, this ain't a marriage, no baby, this is not a marriage. This is a partnership. This is a business deal. And I'm sitting there like, what are they talking about? So I was young when they said that, and I hadn't questioned it. My grandfather since passed, and my grandmother's still around. But I'm still wanting to go ahead and get clarity on that to this day, and I'm trying to figure that out. But I think a lot of people feel that way. You know, it's not a marriage. No. This is a business deal. This is a partnership.
But I can understand that. I mean, and like you said with the last, you know, that's an elusive word in most cases. Hell, you know, I have a million different definitions. So you know that mm-hmm. type of shit. You know, you may have to go into that love shit. I mean, I get that. But you know, if the clarity was there, you know what I'm saying? Hey, this is a partnership. Mm-hmm. You gonna bring this to the table? I'm gonna bring this, and we're gonna work it out. Hey. That's functional. That's functional.
And you know something else? And I can't really down it because they helped raise my dad and my uncles. And honestly, though my uncles are successful, they've never, not that I know of, never been arrested, never had any legal problems, and they've raised their families and stuff, man. So, you know, I can understand a little bit, you know, what my grandmother was getting at. You know, at this point, it's this such and such. But they were successful, right? And they three boys. So it's something to that. I need to think it a little bit, thinking out a little bit more.
You know, the issue, man, of, you know, these young black boys, you know, being with these mothers 90% of the time, even, you know, if a father has visitation rights. But you know, the more time you spend with a young brother, you know, the better it will be. We all know that, I'm sure.
I think the more time you spend with young people in general, I mean, it's better because you don't have a lot of they don't see, especially black folks. They don't really see a lot of us doing. Because I'll deal with, like, because I come to Englewood. And I mean, Cloud knows what I'm talking about. Englewood. A lot of that strong black male figures are gone because he was talking about it earlier. And I think just spending time with a lot of these young people in general is a good thing. If you can, go ahead, pull somebody aside and talk to them. But we don't have those strong adult figures in that area anymore. That's why Englewood's on the news almost every night.
Yeah. And the other thing I think that marriage could, what it does produce is young black men get a chance to see if it's a functional one. Like Clyde was saying, if it's functional, then young brothers and young sisters get a chance to see a functional black relationship. See, that one I even thought about. Now you can see a man, an African man, treating an African woman, you know, a certain way. Now, they wouldn't get that experience. I don't know how they could get that experience, say they were in a house where there was a functional relationship. See, how would they get that piece?
Watching the Brady Bunch just won't do it. Because you go ahead, you come out there, you look around, you be like, wait a minute, this doesn't look like Cindy and Bobby and all them was riding down this street on a nice bike.
I can't say funny, man. My youngest son, is not with my wife. And so his mom sent him to a private school. And so when he would come see me, you know, sometimes pick him up from school, you know, he'd come during sort of St. Patrick's Day, you know, with all that green shit on. You know, day, one day he dressed up like an Indian and shit. You know,
yeah.
And so I told him, I said, one day, I said, oh, okay, man, that's cool. I said, well, where is African Day? And he laughed at me. He said, Dad, you know ain't no African Day. So now, you know, he, one day he's in a damn pilgrim. Then he got on green and shit, Irish. You know, and I mean, this may not have no significance, but just like you said when you said the Brady Bunch, hey, we say that we get everything except, you know, a functional, being a functional damn African.
Yeah. You know something? And you asked them, when was African Day? And if you took that to the school, they'd say that you are a problem and your kid is a problem too, because my sister asked, one of my sisters was asking the same thing. She said, I'm getting sick of my kids coming home with this and that, and I think it was about the same time she got really ticked off around St. Patrick's Day.
Right.
And she went up to the school asking my sister's. Anyway, my sister went up to the school and she got irate, and she got really upset. And so that was last year. So she had she's right now in the process because she said they're done again. My kids ain't going back to the school. She's in the process of going ahead doing a homeschool thing and trying to find other tutors for her kids. And my cousin who lives in Inglewood, I think it was about the same. She went through the same thing with her two kids, that she took her kids out of school because she said, hey, look, there is no African Day. You're not going to go ahead and teach my kid about European history the whole year and then go ahead and say we just popped up here. You know, she said that's not helping us at all. And my cousin, she took her kids out of school. So go ahead, brother. Go ahead.
Yeah, we, and that's what I said, man, we just beating around the bush and shit. I mean, then we all confused when,
right.
You know, the kids don't turn out with no damn sense.
Right.
You know?
Right. So, you know, and then you want to go ahead and something else, you know, and see, you were talking about family. Then you want to go ahead and say, hey, look, you know, them kids over there, they all fucked up. You know, them kids, they all bad and all this other stuff. But hold on. To me, them kids are a reflection of you. If your kids fucked up, you fucked up. So we don't go ahead. We need to call it out and call out these people that's going ahead and doing that kind of stuff. You know, hey, you know, don't go ahead and complain about them kids over there. What are you doing? And that's something that really needs to be go ahead and addressed. It's go ahead and flip the script on a lot of these people. Oh, wow.
Yeah, well, I want one more quick thing. I know you're familiar with Bobby Wright.
Yes, sir.
You're familiar with Dr. Bobby? Okay. And I think it's his last video that's up on YouTube. He says, he's very clear on it. You can watch the video. He said, never use white definitions to try to describe black phenomena. Now, if we're going to give any respect to him, and I think he was one of the leading African Center psychologists. He said this is the most go look at the video. He said this is the most dangerous mistakes blacks can make, to use white definitions to describe black phenomena.
I think I've heard some other doctors say, I think I heard Dr. Umar say something similar.
Whoa. That's deep. And it makes sense.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it does make sense. And I think about Brother Chief Nomo over there and doing the Rites of Passage program in the South Shore community in Chicago, and some of the, you know, one of my mentors, and some of the powerful, like you said, the powerful, you know, black scholars, African scholars that they keep us informed of, all the way up to, like I said, you know, Brother Dr. Kwanzaa Kajufu, who also is I would consider a scholar in his own right. But yeah, you look at the guys, like you said, the Amos Wilsons of the world and many others, and, you know, that
You're right, you know, yeah. You definitely put me on blast. So I definitely have to make sure, you know, I have to make sure I bring it in decency and order moving forward. And, you know, I totally agree with the marriage concept for myself personally. You know, I have yet to have a child, so I don't have the wisdom or the knowledge when it comes to the parental side of things. But you know, me, you know, I've been with my wife, you know, for 10 years, married for 6, as a youngin, you know, even as a young guy. So I definitely embrace the concept of marriage, then baby or babies, absolutely. And then you know. I just have to, because of like what Chef was saying, and what both of you guys are basically saying, is because some people are just not deciding to embrace that concept so far. As we continue to teach them, hopefully we can reach more younger people, you know, kids, teens, and stuff, and get them to embrace the ideas early so that they can start coming together collectively and making a decision, so that when they choose to have a child, it's not some accident or coincidence, but it's somebody that they actually want to build with and not just have sex with. And I think that's probably one of the biggest problems that we lead to, that when people decide to have sex, they don't at least protect themselves and make sure that they're not going to have children if you're not going to build together. And so I think that I agree, you know, it can be troubling not to have, you know, the presence of the two parties, the part together, the male and the female. And some people are opting into the cohabitation, which has become the new school version of, well, I can't say it's not all that new, but it's definitely become a supplement for marriage in many cases for some people who desire to go in that direction as well. In some cases that's been successful for some, and in other cases when somebody opts out of the living arrangement, you know, and leaves the child as well, that can also be problematic as well. And as far as, you know, our brothers and sisters in Inglewood goes, you know, I'm one thing I've been trying to pitch, and I'm still working with some other guys to you know, go pick up some kids and whatnot to get them outside of the neighborhood so they can see more of what's happening beyond, you know, that neighborhood. Because the one of the things I was fortunate enough to do was see beyond, you know, the neighborhood as well. I had the elders, you know, which was the great asset and a great gift, but I also got a chance to see more than just my neighborhood, which also gave me the desire to help my community. And one of the problems that I feel like,
let me hit you with that tour, because I was just thinking almost something similar to that, because you know, you go ahead and I see bus tours, and you see whites and Asians going ahead and taking pictures. I think we need that little bus tour just to go through the hood, go through Inglewood, and let you see what you have over here first, and have somebody narrating and say, hey, look, this is what used to be here. This is how this neighborhood looked. And then also take them outside the neighborhood and go ahead and show them the results of going ahead and what this is how our neighborhood used to look. And this is what these people want to keep you from going ahead and building. See, and I really think
that's a good point.
A whole lot. I think that bus
tour
was a good thing.
Yep.
Yeah, that was really where I was heading in that direction. I was really saying that, you know, when you see, one thing I learned as a kid is that, you know, that there was a huge difference between my neighborhood in those neighborhoods where people were more affluent, where the tax dollars and the resources and so forth and so on were really fueling their local economies. And so,
you
knowing
mean,
that...
Hey, Cloud, you mean You mean dysfunctional communities.
Right.
I mean, that's what that's just saying. I mean, you dysfunctional community.
I think when you see that as a kid, not only do you want it for your own community, but I think when you have, you know, elders around you that are teaching you the value and the importance of building up your own, it causes you not to, you know, it'll teach more kids to start where they are instead of of the community. But and if you start early, look, one of the things I talked to some young guys, and one of my things was to some of these teens was this, is if it's about 20 of you guys and you, then they're all connected, they're all friends. And my thing was, look, instead of splurging on, you know, the unnecessary material things, you guys have to have a long-term plan with the money that you're making from this place, because some of you guys, you might not decide to go to school, but right now, all the stuff you're learning from this Fortune 500 restaurant, you are in school. And so you can take the stuff that you learn here, take that, you know, the little bit of check that you call it, it's a little bit of money, put it together collectively, and you can start doing some group economics planning stuff. And you can start your own things in your little neighborhood, because everything is cheaper for when it comes to buying and to renting. So you can get I showed them stuff like, you know, $9,000 buildings in their neighborhood, and how they can get that real estate. They can work collectively to learn how to, whether they go to Home Depot or wherever, to get some of those skills they need to start doing some work on those places for free.
Yeah.
If they don't want to go to community college. And then they can use that money, those skills, draw up a plan and say, look, you know, some people plan 4 years out down the line for college. You could plan 4 years down the line for your corporation.
Right.
And that's not a long time.
See, that's real time.
That's really not a long time for kids.
Right. And see, that's real-time education, you see? And that's what we got to, you know, this universal education, and we're going to change the public school system. Man, we better move away from that bullshit. But, I mean, you know, what you told them in those few minutes, brothers, I mean, that's a lifetime education. That's real-time education. It connects them. First of all, it connects you. You're connected to them, you see? So you're connected to them for the knowledge that you gave them, and then you're connecting them to the community.
Well,
they got a responsibility to the community.
You know, I've had a discussion and a debate with Buddy Allfax about what is a community. And from what I see, there is no such thing as a black community.
There is no such thing, right.
Yep. So we're going to have to build that up, to build up to go ahead and be a community. And the only thing that this brother kept going ahead doing was repeating the lines that the moderator was saying, because he was going ahead repeating that definition he read. Well, that definition is good. When you are the Brady Bunch, it's a community. But when you from Englewood, it ain't no damn community, because you go ahead and look at what the Brady Bunch had. They can go run on down to Sam's, the butcher shop, and all these other people that's in the area. We ain't got no butcher shop.
Yeah, we can have that.
Okay.
Yeah.
We barely have bakeries. We don't have the same things that you have in these other communities. What you have is just people living in these areas trying to go ahead and survive. And this guy didn't get it, and the host didn't get it, and they still want to go ahead and tell me that, hey, look, they want to keep reading the definition. So your definition does not resemble where black people, especially in Chicago, with its history of redlining and putting black people in certain areas, it does not resemble a community. It does not resemble any white group that's here, any Asian group, any Hispanic group that's here. One of the things I was saying, in order for us to have that community, for me, one of the things has to be there is individuals not going ahead and using public transportation to get to work, and not even using your car. That's one reason the gas price is so high, because they know you got to get fuel your car and go out of the area. If you were able to walk to work, your business, that's building the community, because you're looking out for the people that's in the area, the kids and the elders, and your everything's falling in place for yourself. And them brothers did not get it. They want to keep reading this definition to me, and that definition does not apply to black folks, period.
No
discussion, no more debate, but they want to keep on. So I left it alone.
Yeah, and it's, I'll go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, with it. And the word community's got more than one definition, and the one that he kept using was the one that was general about people living next to each other. But
right,
that's no good in the debate that we have, nor the discussion that we have, because we're talking about the community that's dealing with like minds and organization.
Thank you.
And so, to keep trying to use the definition that we're a community because we live together does not solve the problems of the community that we're trying to build, which is the one that you see the organizational structures, the institutions, and things of that nature. So, I don't know. I ain't hang up on a motherfucker like that. I mean,
You know, and here's something else, and I got to, and how I came across something else talking about nationhood, nation building, and one of the first things it said was, hey, you can't go ahead and build a nation until you build a community first.
Correct.
And community is dealing with a community is dealing with people of like minds. Okay, so
correct.
We have to have a common goal and commonality there, and we need to go ahead. It should be about our survival, not that you come on, you live next to individuals, and that's the community. That's not, and that's what I was hearing in that debate. Because you live next to an individual, to an individual that makes you a community. No,
right. It's not.
The proof
that you have a like mind is the organization and the institutions that you're able to express. Out of that like mind. So even
exactly.
People are talking about we have consciousness, right?
Right.
Well, prove the consciousness.
Right.
The only way you can prove the collective consciousness is through the institutions you build.
Exactly. Okay.
We got a like mind. Where are the institutions to prove that you have a like mind? Where are they
at? Yeah, so you go ahead and you build an industry to go ahead and support the area. Because here's something else. With me, yesterday, I was in Inglewood yesterday. Okay, so I'm looking, and the people, and I bring up the gas thing, because the gas prices there are outrageous versus a few other parts of the city. When in a black neighborhood, it's ridiculous. And there's just really no reason for it other than greed and racism. So if you didn't need to go ahead and fuel your car, I think there'd be a gluttony of gasoline in these damn places. But we don't go ahead and stick together and create something where we don't even have to leave out the neighborhood. People want to go ahead and not leave out the neighborhood because they want to go ahead and do the ill stuff and do nonsense. But if you got everything in your community to go ahead, everything in that area to go ahead and make it a community, you wouldn't need these gas stations. They wouldn't be bleeding you. All these other people that's in the neighborhood that's going ahead also sucking you dry like vampires, don't even live in the area. That's a whole lot of stuff that we need to go ahead and replace to make it a community. At this point in time, we don't have no community.
Correct.
And this might just be me. I'll see what you guys think about it. But I was always a believer that because you gotta be prepared to die for whatever you believe. But you also have to be smart and strategic. And one of my suggestions I said to a couple people before. As I said, you can plan to take over like the spook that stood at the doorstep. The problem is when the enemy knows you're coming, he can prepare for you. But
that's
when you're smiling, juggling and jiving, and you look like another house Negro to the master, by the time you strike him, when he's looking up at you, and you're striking them down, he's trying to figure out how did that happen.
because
you,
all that time,
so,
I thought you was with
let me.
So,
bro. Let me tell you something. You know, I think that strategy, it doesn't work now. You know, I call it the spinning biscuit strategy. You know, when the sister was cooking in the big house, and she'd take a couple of them biscuits and spin them and take them home. You know, I asked the question, I wonder if she believed that the master don't know she's taking two biscuits. She thinks she's getting a little something.
Mm.
All right. Just think about that for a second. The other scenario is this. The way he knows you're coming is when he sees you building institutions. And so there is no other way to – only one culture can occupy one space at one time. There's no such thing as two dominant cultures occupying the same territory. It's never happened. So the concept of taking something over, or the spook who's up by the door, it won't work because he'll know you're coming – by the institutions you're building. And if you say you're not building institutions and you're a spook that's set by the door, then you're not the spook that's set by the door. Or if you is, you're just sitting by the damn door.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If you're organizing for a takeover, that means you're building institutions. You don't think you're gonna see them? You don't think you're going to know where they're at?
That's true.
Yeah?
He has a
functional culture, brother. His culture has a mechanism for that.
Not only that,
just like a functional body.
Not only that, and when you go ahead and you deal with them kind of strategies, you got to have a base. You got to have a base to retreat to go ahead and organize, and your headquarters.
Yeah,
we don't have nothing nowhere near similar to that. I mean, you got these monkeys out here like Al Sharpton and want to go ahead and embrace everybody. I got a problem with that. Go ahead and embrace everybody when you ain't ever dealt with your problems in your house.
Yeah,
you ain't cleaned up your house first. So how can you go ahead and tell everybody we need to go ahead and accept these people and these people? You know, these guys are in it just for money at this point. But
yeah,
go ahead,
yeah.
I mean, I did an interview with, two-part interview with that brother Sam Greenlee, who wrote the Spook Who Sat by the Door. Okay, and he was saying, hey, it was some of the stuff he was saying about black people, I had to come back and listen to the show. It was painful, and he made a few points that made me giggle, but it was painful because he saw back then. That, hey, look, this was something to help you, and along with the other brothers who put stuff into place. But he said, he don't see too much of people doing stuff, and they're doing stuff in little bitty baby steps and letting these monkeys go ahead and do all the talking for us.
If you look at the movements, man, that's came before us, and look at and just peruse like BTR Blog Talk Radio, and just listen to the types of strategies and the suggestions that the younger African generation is doing. It's almost like child's play compared to what some of the brothers and sisters have done 50 and 60 and 70 and 80 years ago.
True.
Yeah,
you got a point.
Well, I forget that movie where the cat. He was an old man, or someone getting older, younger. It's almost like, man, we got a disease of getting old. when you look at the strategies, man, I bet some of the cats like Marcus Garvey, and like you said, a brother, Sam, you know, some of the ones there, like, man, what is these niggas doing?
Yeah, man, really?
Think about it. Even W.E.B. Bison, like, man, what? What did you guys do, man?
You got guys around you got some guys around right now who read all of their works, read a lot of those books, read a lot of their life stories about, you know, Dr. John Henry Clark and, They be the boy with Marcus Garvey. And they go ahead, and they be trying to tell them, no, y'all doing it wrong. But them guys get ridiculed. Them guys go ahead and get put down. And another brother I was listening to who was going ahead and almost verbatim going ahead and reading our stuff from Chancellor Williams' book and his blueprint. And these guys who go ahead now get ridiculed and put down and they're like, oh, that's not going to work. A lot of that stuff will work. I feel a lot of that stuff will work, but you have to polish it up for 2015. Okay, not 14, 2015. You have to polish it all up to go ahead and fit into what's going on. I mean, they made the blueprint. I mean, that's what our opponents are doing. They already has been laid out for them a long time ago. So all they're doing is just brushing off the plan. They get their think tanks together and say, okay, well, we already got this going on. So how do we improve on that? And I see a whole lot of black folks want to go ahead and be like, oh, that's not going to, we need something else different. No, you don't. You go ahead and deal with what worked. I heard another brother go ahead and talk a lot of crap about we can't go ahead and have that Rosewood. We can't go ahead and have that Black Wall Street thing again. I was like, is this dude nuts? You go on what worked. We didn't destroy that. We actually was doing something fine and perfect at that point. So we need to get that back and polish it up for modern day. We don't go ahead and throw away their plans. I mean, that's crazy. And it was a bunch of other nonsense. But the bottom line is this: when some brothers and sisters come and say, "Hey, look, well, we need to take what we have and build it up, and based off some of the ideas that already work, and that will go ahead and help us out." You got too much opposition out here going ahead making those baby steps, like you're saying, and have no clue as to what Marcus Garvey or the modern day Garveyite is saying. And it's sad, and it's ridiculous, and it's just going ahead taking us in circles and circles, and we ain't getting nowhere.
Yeah, that's a problem. You know, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm. So is.
Yeah.
You know, these cats seem to be satisfied talking in circles and talking in circles. I mean, like, okay, you know, and talking in circles and not figuring out, not going ahead and figuring out everything costs money. You better start talking that money right off the bat.
Yeah, you know, what you need is not a litmus test, but some type of formula so you can weed out the bullshit. And I'm serious.
Yeah.
You know, one day our family was getting together. This was years ago. We was, you know, talking about investing and, you know, this was up. So what we did, we said, okay, well, we want everybody to pitch it now so we can get some notebooks and some pencils so we can start taking notes when we come to the meeting. Ain't nobody got no damn money.
Hey, you know why I laugh? Because I seen that, because when I was growing up, my mom, her sisters, because it's like about, you know, like eight of them, all her sisters came together. Plus, they had cousins and extended cousins, and it was at the end of the day, it was about, I say close to 30-some of them, right? They created their own corporation. They was doing fundraising. They were going ahead with a lot of the money. They was taking care of the kids, taking care of us because they were single parents. Going ahead, providing what the kids need. So-and-so ain't got no food. Go ahead, we're going to do some shopping and go ahead and bring food back. Okay? That's it. And my mom, what I love, she sent out a piece talking about family because she was talking about what's going on today. And she said, what we did this, we did that. Okay, so What my mom's family was trying to do was go ahead and bring our family together to go ahead and just to have family reunions. When they got into the room and they started talking about the money, first they was talking about what we need to do. And when they got to talking about the money, everybody started looking crazy,
it's
looking
over.
At their shoes.
It's over.
Looking at the wall. And I kept saying, man, our parents put it together based on nothing. And they were going ahead and doing all kinds of fundraising. At one point, they were doing fundraising so tough here in Chicago, throughout the West Side and a few other places. They were renting halls, throwing parties, and they was packing them halls. packing them a whole lot, and they was traveling, going in and out the country, going to a bunch of places. And my aunt and a couple of my cousins actually quit their job just to run that thing. And when I joined the military and I came back, it had all dissolved, and I still don't know to this day what happened. But they was doing it. But when it comes to a lot of our families, black families, when you go ahead and say it's going to cost money, you get crickets in the room, or you get everybody looking at the wall, or somebody who figured out, oh yeah, oh, all of a sudden I'm autistic, or I got some kind of brain mental illness. They don't understand nothing you talk about.
Well, you know, I say, like I was telling brothers and said, man, we need to get our damn kids out of public school. I said, okay. I said, of course I know you're right. I said, but what if all these sisters y'all talking to one day say, okay, y'all right. Tomorrow, I'm not going to take my kids to the public school. Can you tell me where I can drop them off at the, you know, where is this? Is it, y'all got the Afrocentric school set up? You see, then that makes the, you know, the rubber meets the road. See, we do a lot of talking, but we don't do a lot of building. And I think, I mean, until we be honest, you know, and say, hey, we better figure out this money piece. But that's really what it's going to take. It's going to take some guerrilla economics to try to get us out of this rut. But, you know, we're good at talking, but we're not good at building. And I think we're not good at building because we're not honest. We either don't want to sacrifice the little money we have, or we ain't got it. And we need to be honest with each other, and we need to say that.
That whole thing, you know, like I said, when they want to come together and talk about but this is what we should do, where the money coming from? Where the money coming from? You need to go ahead and discuss that. And that's the problem with almost every black area. Like I said, we ain't got no communities. There's no such thing as a black community.
No such thing.
But we need to go ahead and go ahead and put it out there on the table. The thing that will go ahead and cure these ills in these black areas is finances. But not just go ahead and throw money at the problem. It has to be done with some kind of organizational structure, some kind of planning, and ways to go ahead and see the thing today and in the future on where we're planning to be. And when you go ahead and you're trying to get people to go ahead and talk about it, then if they go ahead and say, we have to go ahead and look at individuals out here because I know we've seen it. What's my share? We all get paid the same thing. Well, I put in more work than so-and-so. For me, at that point, I say, get your ass the hell up out of here. You ain't helping at all.
Well, you look at like, for instance, like Detroit. Now, you know, Detroit may be right as far as location for, you know, the conscious blacks and, you know, blacks who say we need to build communities. It's ripe for that type of situation because of the fall of the infrastructure of the dominant community and the business infrastructure. So, you see, and so when the whites double back and take Detroit, then we'll be talking shit, right? I mean, let's get real. The blacks gonna be talking shit, but I mean, you got an opportune time now for blacks with. Who said they organized? Who said they have? We have the resource. We got 50 billion. You know, we got 50 billion buying power. Trillion dollars, which those numbers are bogus. But okay, so now here's the opportunity. You got a location that's vulnerable, right? The infrastructure has collapsed for the most part. The spook that's out by the door. Now you can get in there. You know, and nobody paying a lot of attention to it. So when we don't do that, and then the white community in 10 years, it's all white, they went to my right, they took Detroit from us.
You know, the bigger problem,
yeah.
I mean, I agree with that, and I see it this way. Not only Detroit is right, every city in America, even across the globe, is go ahead good to go ahead and do a lot of recruitment to go ahead and support your cause. In Chicago, you go ahead and look at what they're doing here in Chicago. It's nothing to go ahead and say that, hey, look, you couldn't go ahead and use every event that's happened just this past, just since the Independence Day. use those events and go ahead with the murders and this and this and how they view it. Go ahead and look at how each level of government is taking that money and not going ahead and putting no money and going ahead and try to go ahead and help what's going on over here. And I try to go ahead and I bring it up for this reason about the government and our people. I mean, you're taking our tax dollars, but you're spending it somewhere else. And people will go ahead and say, oh, you want to go ahead and get government handouts. Oh, you damn right. Because I don't see nothing wrong with that. That's the purpose
of government.
Yeah, and I don't see nothing wrong with that. I mean, like, you're giving trillions of dollars to the oil industry. They still getting subsidized. The farm industry, you're giving them money, and the food prices are going through the roof. I don't get why I can't go ahead and get my fair share of the pot. I paid into it. I need to get some out of it. And I go ahead and I got a problem when people go in and say, oh, you want welfare. You damn right. I paid into it. And if I want to sit on my ass and not do nothing, I should be able to go ahead and get some of that money. I paid into it. So I can't stand all them silly conversations when people had them conversations and not go ahead and nobody point out the reality. The reality is if you go ahead, we get that money, and we put that money into the community, into the education system, we can go ahead and build up a whole lot of stuff. And I'm not talking about just going, I need to go ahead and create a school, which you can also employ a lot more people in the neighborhood. I think one of the brothers was mentioning that. Create that school, that learning institution, that we can go ahead and employ other people in the neighborhood. Okay, so you have some skills that you can teach other children, other people in the area, but there's other things needed to run that school. I mean, it just don't, to me, a lot of stuff don't balance out. It's just a whole lot of BS and nonsense out here, man, and we're going ahead. The real messages are getting blocked out by the BS and the nonsense.
Yeah, and I think you guys are definitely pointing a lot of the key points out. I mean, a lot of the information that was presented to us historically is there. We just have to read it and upgrade it so that it could be current. Like you said, the Black Wall Streets. We made our own schools. We built our own infrastructure, literally within the Americas. And so, and then we can look at the past and go and dig back to Africa and still get some of that insight. So we can look at all those. Like you said, there are a lot of examples out there for us. But like you said, when it comes to the investment component, I found that out myself too. Is when it comes to putting the money there, then everybody says, man, I'm broke or I don't have it or something. But when we were coming to the table, it was, yeah, let's do it. And everybody had money until we had to put the money in the pot. Then, like you guys said, that's when it changes. And that's even with, like, families. I remember having a discussion with some extended family, not my immediate, but some deep down in the distance part, but still family. And they were came to me with the banking concept, and they knew I could pull some information. So they said, "Yeah, we should start our own credit union." And I got excited, and I met up with them, and we talked, and then next thing you know, it didn't come into fruition. The money part, you know, people couldn't find a way to get that, and so, you know. It was a lot of research that was done for nothing because people didn't want to, like you said, bring the money to the table. And so what are some, I mean, like, man, you guys brought up a good point about weeding out the tear, so to speak. And I'm really interested in hearing that strategy, the weeding out the tears part, because you talked about the forum, I think, of some sort or something like that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, what I'm saying, like, for instance, with some of the work that we do in Uganda, and we, you know, we're talking to brothers and sisters in the States, well, for instance, if you can't show us a certain measure of your ability to organize, you say, we need 5 Gs. You say, well, I don't personally have 5 Gs, okay. Well, if you can't show us your ability to organize 5 Gs from people you know, then you're not quite ready. I'm just giving you a simple example, because when this is not being arrogant. You're saying, well, I personally have not developed my personal finances enough where I'm ready to make some moves. And in addition to that, I have not shown the ability to organize enough individuals around a particular idea or concept to raise $5,000. We said, well, you're not quite mm-hmm. ready.
Got you. Hmm. Oh, man, keep expounding on that. I like this. I'm learning.
So to me, that's why you have to be centered around, we say, like-minded. See, once you determine a project, actually, it's easy to hide when everybody's talking. The bullshitters can hide in the talk. But once an idea is put on the table and then everybody has a responsibility to bring this to the table, you're going to start weeding them out. That's the long method of weeding them out. But so we have a way of, like, interviewing and documentation that we can use to determine if a person is ready to move. So that's what we use. But, I mean, that's where we're at now. I mean, at some point we got to stop talking and start doing.
I think that was definitely useful information.
I want you to finish. I even want to work with you because I got a 501c3 and I'm trying to go ahead and push that. I've been doing all the boot, moving around and running around doing, trying to get this thing right and try to go ahead and get my grants looking together, go ahead and get my proposals looking together so I can apply for some stuff because the fuckers I got on my board ain't about nothing. I'm just letting them stay there till I can go ahead and get to a point where I can go ahead and do something and go ahead and replace them. So everything I've been trying to do, my thing is about farming and agriculture. And I would love to connect with the brothers and sisters in Uganda. Any place, any connection on the continent is possible. Any connection over there would be great for me. So, brother, please, holler at me. Let me know what's going on. But I want to go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, and really, bro, that's probably where the beginning of the success will come, particularly when you come to a certain threshold and you know it's hard to organize the people in America. The ground is more fertile on the continent, and quite frankly, even the return, if you're looking at it from a monetary perspective, even the return is more valuable. Okay, like you just said, farming. Well, now, mechanized farming is that field is wide open in a lot of places in Uganda and, quite frankly, probably all over the continent. So, okay, you had mentioned a nonprofit. I've developed probably about 6 nonprofits. And I can probably tell you right now, first of all, you're having a hard time finding funding. And particularly from mainstream philanthropists who don't share, in other words, they have absolutely no interest in black farming in America. Now, you can
wait a minute. Hold on, brother. So you've been reading them turndown letters I've been getting and all that bad email. Is that what you're saying? You're a hacker or something?
You see what I'm saying?
Because, man, I'm having such a hard time, and I don't want to put some people on blast until I get to a certain threshold. But, man, it's some known people here. Entertainers. I done been in their circle, and I'm like, okay, well, brother, I need to help. Yeah, well, you're going to have to get with so-and-so and such-and-such. Hey, give me your card, and we'll go ahead and call you, and you call us, and nothing materialized. And these people always putting, like the couple of the entertainers that I met, that I've been around, that I've seen for a few years. When I came up with this concept, now they don't want to get involved. Okay, so I've gotten that pushback and it's been heavy. And then I had to go ahead and get so drunk one day, man. I had to just forget what planet I was on. Because you talk a whole lot of stuff, but you ain't about it. And at the same time, these kids and innocent people are dying, but you go ahead and want to make money off what's going on. And it just made me sick, real sick to my stomach that day. Y'all go ahead, man, because it's about to go ahead and bring back them emotions. I was pissed.
Yeah.
I hope you're not talking about George Daniels. I was more or less talking about some Jack Daniels, because I didn't want to go here.
Put people on blast.
Oh, no. In a little while, I'll go ahead and do it. I'll let you know who that is, but I want to get to a certain threshold and go ahead and let people. Was it George Daniels? I know that name, but I was looking for Jack Daniels to relieve me.
So what are you doing, developing community gardens? I mean, what's the foundation of that?
The only thing that I really have done was giving some cooking lessons. Okay?
Okay,
I've got
all
people
right.
to go
okay.
ahead and commit their farmland to me so we can go ahead and do something. I go ahead and I pick some fruits, pick some vegetables, and I teach people how to cook it. And I've gotten commitments from individuals. Oh, yeah, you can use that land right over there. So I've gotten a little money from Lowe's and Home Depot. Well, I got equipment. And I brought some young people over there. And when I brought some young people over to this one street in Inglewood, man, The neighbors called the police. All them young people over in that yard, what are they doing over there?
Yeah.
So, man, you talk about frustration, man, and the cops came up. When I let them know what was going on, they started laughing. Oh, they thought it was a game fight. People got all these weapons and stuff. Man, I'm like, oh, come on. Man, so it's real frustrating. And I'm literally, a lot of times I'm standing by myself because the guys I'm supposed to be on got my back. Oh, man, I got to do this. Oh, man, my son's going to hear me going over. Oh, I got to do something, such. And I know they're lying.
Yeah.
I know they're lying. So I don't even
know. You might have to pull back for a minute, bro. I'd probably rather talk to you not on this venue. So, but let me see. Hey, you, Claude, does the entire phone number pop up? When you call in?
Yes, sir.
Yes, okay. Get my number. Hey, I'll give you my number. 847-877.
Okay. Hold on one second, bro.
Man, because it's real frustrating. And I just see so much stuff we can do with the farming and agriculture. Hell, and I brought up the thing about the gas prices earlier. Hey, we can develop our own biofuels to run our own cars and stuff. And I, you know.
All right, go ahead. 847-877-6207.
Okay. All right. Yeah, man, you know, it's frustrating as hell. And my cousin is in Nigeria. Okay. He hooked it up where he's got like close to 100 acres of land. He's like, Rob, come on, man. Well, let's get this together, man. Let's get this together because we can go ahead and send stuff back, blah, 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 blah. I said, man, I can't. I got two of my cousins on the board. And he's like, I told him who they were. He's like, oh, man, I can't believe they out here bullshitting like that. It's just frustrating, bro. It's real frustrating, man. Because I spend more time, I burn up more gas running around, going here talking to people, sitting in these crappy nonsense meetings, and listening to people, and going here talking to these old. I need to talk to a few. The community developers for the banks and stuff, man. These guys just can't wait to get you out of their office.
Yeah, community reinvestment officers.
Yeah, they fuck, man. Ooh.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's frustrating, man.
What about the residents of Greater Inglewood?
I've been over to and they got information. Basically, they got information because I had been doing a lot of stuff on the west side first. So for me, what was going on the west side of Chicago, they were really moving at a snail's pace. So I had got in touch with a few people out south since I also got people in Inglewood, I started coming over there. So I've only been dealing with them basically this year because other than the last couple of years I've been dealing with the people on the west side. And this, they've been having ups and downs and kissing the ass of the politicians and trying not to go ahead and tell the truth about it.